Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast that brings you conversations from across the progressive movement. During the show, we speak with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and campaigners about how we come out of these unprecedented times in much better shape than we went in. I'm Frances Foley, your host today and Deputy Director of Compass. Compass is a place where people come together to create the visions, alliances, and actions to be the change we wish to see in the world. We're interested in the how of political change as much as the what, and we think conversations like these are a great place to start. Compass members can join the call live and can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to be part of it, go to action.compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, grab your drink of choice, and get ready to get complicated. So, without further ado, I'm going to say a huge welcome tonight to our two distinguished guests. We have Dana Glendinning, who is a long-standing New Zealand Green Party campaigner, and like everybody on the call, I think, or many people on the call tonight, an MMP advocate. And we have Max Rashbrook, who's a senior lecturer, researcher at Victoria University and a writer focusing on democracy and inequality. And tonight, I expect us to have a very popular conversation for our members and supporters here on the call, because we're going to be hearing how New Zealand shifted from first past the post to a proportional representative system. And we will dig into a little bit the story of the twists and turns about how that happened. And also, I hope you will bombard Max and Dana with your questions, everything about the challenges, the opportunities, the big characters at play, and how it actually happened. So hopefully kind of inspiring conversation tonight. I know that I've been inspired just learning about the story from New Zealand. And whilst we can't, you know, would that we could, but just transplant what happened in New Zealand to the UK, I know that there'll be lots for us to learn as fellow campaigners and allies along this journey. So before we kick off the conversation in earnest, I'm going to say hello to Dana and Max and ask you to just start by saying, as we always do with our guests, where are you and how are you? And we're going to start with you, Max.
Well, hello, everyone. Lovely to be part of this. I am in Wellington, the capital city, where the weather is characteristically cold and miserable. The two cities I've lived in at any serious extent of my life have been London and Wellington. And I always say to people, I don't move places because of the weather, and which isn't currently it's bearing out that theory. But otherwise, I'm great and very pleased to be here with you all.
Brilliant. That's great to hear. And I just do want to say to both of our guests tonight, a massive thank you. As people on the call will know tonight, New Zealand is a very different time zone to here. And so both of our guests have got up insanely eye-wateringly early to be here. So a huge thanks to you both for that. And over to you, Dana. Whereabouts are you based and how are you?
I live in Taupo, and I haven't looked outside yet or pulled the curtains. So I don't know what the weather is like, but I think it's probably wet. It's been very wet lately.
Yeah, so I think very similar to British conditions, it seems like, or general British conditions, though not actually at the moment. It's a golden afternoon here. So before we properly dig into the conversation, I thought it was useful to outline for folks on the call who don't know about the session, particular story behind the New Zealand's shift to MMP or mixed member proportional system. And so I'll do my best at giving like a 1 minute potted, maybe 1.5 minute potted version of how this happened. As I said at the start, there's lots of different kind of turns of this story. And what I think one of the biggest things that we can take away from it is that at every point there were challenges, at every point there were contestations, at every point it looked like it possibly couldn't happen. And so for campaigners here in the UK who may still feel that PR is still very far away, despite the advances and developments we've seen over the last few years, I just want us to hold on to the faith, hold on to the possibility that things can change. And New Zealand is a great example of that. So I want to take us right back to kind of 1985, where a lot of this story kind of began. I wasn't even alive at that time. but the real starting point of this, I felt like from the position of a foot in the door and maybe just an opening for campaigners, was this the establishment of a commission to look at the electoral system. And that was a kind of formal acknowledgement by a lot of parties involved that campaigners for many years from different parts of the political spectrum had been dissatisfied with the voting system in New Zealand. The Commission unsurprisingly looked at many different proportional representative systems around the world and did a lot of kind of visits to different countries. And they came out by recommending this system called mixed member proportional system, which is very similar to what we call AMS here in the UK, additional member system, very similar to the German model as well, at that time, the West German model. And then pressure for this was building over the course of a couple of years. And there were kind of an interesting pivot moment where in 1987, campaigners asked the then Labour leader sort of live during a debate whether he would commit to holding a referendum on the voting system if elected. And he surprised a lot of people by saying yes, which is fascinating to me to show that actually when you put people on the spot, interesting things can be opened up and happen. But unfortunately, as we have seen in other systems, other structures and other countries, as in the UK, this didn't end up actually happening. So the 1990 election, which came around then, the national leader then held Labour's feet to the fire and said, this is a broken promise. You said that you would hold a referendum on the voting system and you didn't end up doing this. So we fast forward to 1992, where both major parties pledged a referendum, which was quite a seismic shift then from positions even sort of 5 to 10 years earlier. And the referendum would ask two questions. And this is one of the most fascinating bits of the story, I would say. So the first question that New Zealand citizens were asked was, do you think we should change the voting system? Just a flat out sort of yes and no. And it was thought that if the majority answered no to this question, then that would kind of answer the question, at least for a generation, and that would be put the matter to bed. And then the second question put across four different systems that could be advocated. And it was thought that if there was a clear majority for one of those particular systems, then that would be put up against first past the post in a head-to-head referendum. And that is actually what happened. So a very large majority of New Zealanders thought that there should be a change. And there was around 70% in favour of MMP, the mixed member proportional system. And so it came to be that in 1993, on the same day as the general election, there was a referendum. While starting out from a position of a lot of grassroots campaigning, which I'm sure we'll hear about from Max and Dana, they actually, as tends to happen, the polls kind of narrowed closer to the referendum. And I read some interesting articles at the time which said, actually, this is really in question whether the shift is going to happen. But on the day, it came down to the percentage that won, the majority was 53.9% in favour of changing the voting system and 46.1% against. And then the first referendum to be held under this PR system was in 1996. And since then, New Zealand has had PR, so this mixed member proportional system. And we're going to hear tonight also towards the end of the conversation how this might have changed the culture and the practice of politics in New Zealand at large. So forgive me for that short, just little potted history. And I'm sure my guests will correct me if I got anything wrong on that. But I wanted to start by asking first Dana and then Max about maybe your own personal involvement with the campaign. And just a brief kind of what you were doing at the time, what were you involved in, and what were your kind of memories of this campaigning moment?
Okay, first, Dana. In the 70s and 80s, I was a farmer's wife, a sheep farmer's wife. And for some reason, I went to a large United Women's Convention in Wellington. I knew nothing about the women's movement or any of these things. But as a result of that, the women's electoral lobby was formed in New Zealand all over the country, and I got involved in that, although it took me an hour to drive to meetings. And then I was at a meeting in Hamilton, and I became aware that the women's electoral lobby rep on the Electoral Reform Coalition wasn't doing what I thought they should be doing. So I offered to be on it. And by that time, I was friendly with Rod Donald, who was active in the campaign and a Green and things. And then I was on the committee. And that's really how it began. Yes. And then I was standing as the Alliance, which was a group candidate for Wellington Central, and I could see that getting MMP was much more important than being the Alliance candidate. So I sort of gave up being the Alliance candidate and spent my time working in the MMP office in the PSA and running it all.
Brilliant. Well, we'll come to you in a second to ask some questions about how the twists and turns of that campaign. But over to you, Max. What were your sort of memories from the early stages of the campaign?
Oh, well, far fewer, in a sense, than Dana's. I mean, I was, I was just still at primary school, even, sort of sitting for the first referenda. So I don't remember a huge amount directly, but I do remember, well, so we had to do some projects on it at school. And I think one of my tasks at school was I had to do a presentation explaining how MMP actually worked. And I know we've already got a question about that in the Q&A. And I also remember, because in the campaign itself, there were fantastic people like Dana campaigning for MMP, for change, but there was also a campaign led for the status quo. And as Dana will remember vividly, it was both, the figurehead was this guy called Peter Shirtcliffe, who was a sort of big sort of business magnate kind of guy who was the head of New Zealand's equivalent of British Telecom, which had recently been privatised, and sort of an immensely unpopular figure. And he was defending First Past the Post, or FPP, which had worked very well for him and for his sort of his circle of business people. And I remember even then the joke that went round that was that FPP stood for Phil Peters' pockets, because it was just, it was a system guaranteed to reward big business, and big businesses were very fond of it. But fortunately, although they put a lot of money into the campaign against MMP, they weren't, fortunately, the forces of light in the form of Dana and others were victorious.
He sued me because I wrote a letter saying he was telling lies. That stopped me in my tracks a minute.
Just a minute, though, not that long. So I wanted to just come back to this how it all kicked off. And I mean, the formal kind of opening, which I wanted to hear whether you thought this was correct, Dana, whether, you know, this question about the Royal Commission being set up. I wanted to ask what kind of impetus that gave to campaigners who were already convinced about the need for reform. What did that mean, well, for the campaign, if anything?
I think it really began a long time before that with the growth of social credit, which was a small farmer, small business group. And they got in 78, they got a large percentage of the vote, but they not got no seats. That happened twice. And then also what happened was there were two elections when Labour got more votes than National, and yet National ended up as the government. And so those things, even if you weren't an avid supporter of MMP, both of those, social credit not getting any seats and the party getting the most votes, didn't get to be the government. And that spurred a lot of people on, and ordinary people felt was quite unfair, really. And so I think that Justice Wallace, Rod used to call it his Bible, the report that that Justice Wallace did was very thorough, and because he was someone of considerable standing and the other people on that committee, that gave quite a lot of weight to it. But the thing was that none of the politicians on either side, except for Geoffrey Palmer, really supported it. You know, the prime ministers and leaders of the opposition were thoroughly opposed. You know, I was thinking in the last few days, we were a group of nobodies, really, and we won. So don't give up.
That's exactly right. Why I wanted you to say, Dana. And I really do think it's really important to make this point that, like, there was nobody supporting this. Go on, Max, what did you want to add to that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that's a really good account. I mean, and Dana, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I think that minor party you referred to, Social Credit, won something like 20% of the vote, didn't they, in one election? And they might have got about two seats out of it. I mean, it was just a, you know, outrageous sort of result. I mean, I think the rest of the story is an interesting combination of sort of planning and chance, it seems to me. I mean, this is just from my reading of history, obviously not really having been there. Because, you know, Geoffrey Palmer, you know, who was a legal academic who became an MP, you know, I mean, he had the foresight, I think, to get a remit up within the Labour Party, so Labour Party conferences, to say we should have a commission on the electoral system. And, you know, and then when Labour won in 84, they were in a position to actually do that. And so that was a bit of, you know, good planning, sort of using the system to create this thing that then, as Dana said, became a Bible. But then, of course, I think there was a fair element of chance as well, because I don't think, you know, I don't think anyone involved in that process, including Palmer, who by this stage was Deputy Prime Minister, had necessarily thought that it was going to lead to MMP. You know, I think there was a sense that change was needed. Even members of the Royal Commission, I don't think, well, a number of them weren't MMP advocates at the beginning at all, but, you know, they went on this process of study and learning. I think they went to Germany as part of their work, and they came out of it, you know, convinced that MMP was the best possible system. So there was a bit of planning and a bit of chance there, and then you had the planning of people like Dana and Phil Saxby, the guy who was leading a lot of the electoral reform work, the guy who put the David Longley, the Prime Minister, you know, on the spot on camera. But then you also sort of had a large element of chance, I guess. And the thing that I always think about is that, you know, the New Zealand public was really, really fed up with their politicians at this stage, because without going too much into the details, you know, a Labour government elected in 1984, but which then sort of out-thatchered Thatcher and implemented these incredibly hard right economic reforms and broke quite a few promises along the way. And then they were replaced with our equivalent of a Conservative government, the National Party, in 1990, who then promptly broke a bunch of their promises as well. And having campaigned on restoring the decent society, then did some really horrible things like cutting benefits by about a quarter of their value. And so you probably don't want to underestimate just how much, you know, distrust and hatred there was towards politicians at the time, and to what extent of both sides. I mean, it was a real, my sense was it was a real plague on both your houses kind of dynamic. And my sense of the history is that distrust of politicians right across the spectrum was pretty crucial in getting some change across the line that we might otherwise not have had.
So we've got some good conditions that we share there with the UK at the moment, I would say, in terms of the last 10 years of political parties and, you know, a lot of disaffection and apathy. But what we want is that people to channel that, you know, frustration into positive structural change. So to come to you, Dana, on this question of, so you're right, obviously a lot of people can only hear about the kind of formal process and mechanisms which focus a lot on the parties and parliament and the referendum. But of course, we all know that kind of these sorts of changes don't happen without a really significant grassroots organizing effort, which often plays out over the course of years, if not decades. And it's often this kind of mood music which sets the scene for referendums campaigns. And then, as you say, Max, you know, useful ins can happen and useful chance encounters and useful opportunities. So what would you say the Electoral Reform Coalition, from your perspective, Dana, did well, kind of operationally and organisationally, to kind of galvanise people?
Well, the Electoral Reform Coalition was formed before I, you know, joined the fight. But it had Colin Clark, and he was a very respected head of the public service, PSA, the Public Services Association. And the Public Service Association, actually, we worked out of their office. I think they paid all our bills. And so while the people with the Shirtcliffe crowd had lots of money, we didn't have, you know, we were fairly assured that the unions, and particularly the PSA, were picking up the tabs for a lot of it. But I think we never would have won without that strong union support and the sort of person, you know, people like respectable people. And Colin Clark was a respectable person. And then later on, Nikki Hager and Kevin Hackwell, who were two Native Forest Action people who sat up trees on the West Coast to save the bush, they came and joined us, and they had a lot of campaigning experience and sort of fun gaming, which people like me didn't have. And I can't remember, you know, they taught us lots of tricks of the trade. And I think that we never would have won without Nikki and Kevin, I don't think. We did have, I see people said we had a high level of organisation and sophistication. I'm not sure that I would have said that, but I can't remember, you know, it's hard to know because when did email come in and when did faxes come in? I can't quite remember, but I remember we used to write letters to the papers and fax them through and the papers print, you know, and other people's names in them. And, you know, people printed them and, you know, it's amazing things that happened and which I, as an ordinary sort of farmer's wife, didn't know anything about, but I learned, you know. And I'd had quite a lot of actually campaigning in my own community for lots of the other things like school buses and television and things like that, which I think helped. Maybe I was respectable, you know.
Yeah. No, and I think this is really important that people have come from other campaigns, other campaigns which have very different issues maybe at the heart of them, but people can say, no, actually, I can't make any progress on my issue unless we change something about the structure of how we do democracy. So to ask you, Max, as well, I mean, I know you were still at primary school, but even looking back, do you think this sort of caught the mood of the nation in terms of, you know, you said it's responded to people's kind of disappointment and frustration and anger at the parties, but also was it something that people were culturally invested in? Were people like talking about it? Did it kind of capture the imagination of people? Were people sort of, was it something that kind of got people's enthusiasm, as have been seen at other referendums, and thinking notably of sort of the Scottish referendum, which was of course on a sort of, in lots of ways, a sort of a kind of bigger constitutional question, but, you know, very significant nonetheless, that this election was, this referendum was coming round. Do you think it sort of really caught the public mood at a time?
Yeah, I think it did. That's my recollection. And I think that changed. And I mean, and this is just from me reading the history, but, you know, certainly at one point, Geoffrey Palmer, you know, still Deputy Prime Minister, or he might even have been Prime Minister at this point, effectively had to, well, he almost abandoned, you know, the cause because there wasn't any interest in it. You know, he wasn't getting contacted about it. He wasn't getting those letters to the editor, letters to MPs that Dana talked about. And then I think that shifted over time, you know, particularly with both parties breaking their promises in such spectacular fashion. And then I think there was, I mean, again, Dana can probably talk to it better than I can, but I think there, I mean, and it did capture people's imagination, which is quite hard to do because it's very abstract, you know, systems of government. Understanding MMP is not straightforward. Unfortunately, I think there's probably quite a few New Zealanders who still have not really quite got their head around it all these years later. So it wasn't an obvious one, but I think because it caught the mood of dissatisfaction in the country and it presented itself as a, you know, a clear opportunity to do something different. And because we had these egregious examples that Dana mentioned of Labour, you know, winning more votes than National but getting fewer seats, I think there was a mood for change. And so I remember these things like FPP, you know, Phil Peters' pockets. I mean, there were cartoons and stuff going around. There was a, you know, we were talking about it in primary school. There was a really heightened degree of interest in it, but certainly at that moment, yeah.
I think also that the listener, who is probably the most widely read magazine in New Zealand at the time, the listener got behind it. I'm not actually sure quite why. And also the Anglican Church was another sort of respectable organisation, which generally tends to be quite progressive in New Zealand. And they got behind it. And you know, those, you know, the listener had pages and pages of support for MMP, which, you know, was crucial to the you know, to the people who make things happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to ask you both this kind of, there's a perennial question in the UK about, it's a question of strategy, but I'm interested in it, how it relates to what happened in New Zealand. So, you know, and some people would say, well, unless you win over the politicians who are actually going to be the people to implement this, and they're heavily invested often in the current system, unless you can win those people over, it sort of feels like a shift to PR is doomed to failure. And of course, you do need somebody from the inside, as it were, to kind of open the door, as was done with the Royal Commission, and then obviously with leaders who came behind the idea of a referendum, at least. But I'm also interested in the fact that we just talked about this this mood music and what's happening out in the wider country and connecting with people's dissatisfaction and disaffection. And of course, every campaign has to do a bit of both and manage that kind of alchemy. But I'm interested to hear both of you speak to the sort of tactical weighting of that, and especially in this campaign. You know, how much was it sort of an insider campaign where it was trying to win over people who were invested? And how much was it focusing on the public and the parties, especially with limited resources in the Electoral Reform Coalition, at least? Come to you, Jenna, first, and then Max.
I don't think that we tried to change the minds of the leaders, because they clearly said they didn't agree. So it was a campaign with the people. I've been associated with the Get PR Done in Britain for about 3 years now, encouraging them and supporting them. And I think they're doing a good job and they're making progress. I can't understand why the Labour Party doesn't pull finger and accept it, really. You know, I'm sure it would be in their interest, but they haven't. But, you know, I just say to those Alan Story and people, keep going, build and build, and you'll get there.
Well, that's motivating. That is motivating. How about you, Max? How do you see that kind of tension?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'd agree with that. I mean, as I look at it, you know, from the perspective of history, it feels more like, yeah, sort of a series of dominoes falling. I mean, you had Geoffrey Palmer, who was obviously, you know, convinced of the need for some change. You get the Royal Commission. And then it was sort of, you know, getting the Labour Party, even if sort of accidentally committed to it. It seems to me, you know, in retrospect, that sort of set the dominoes falling, because then they were committed to something. And okay, they reneged on it. But then the opposition party, National, wanted to hold them to account for their broken promise, which sort of got National in a funny position of, you know, quasi supporting the idea of reform, even though they weren't really enthusiastic. And then that's what, and then so then this idea was sitting there when all these, you know, sort of scandals and broken promises happened, just from that sort of series of dominoes falling, proportional representation was the idea sitting around to be picked up as a thing that, oh, we can do this to restore trust. It's very striking looking back at the history, just how intensely the politicians were opposed to it. And even people who are now thought of as sort of, you know, kind of almost progressive, well, not quite heroes, but someone like Helen Clark, you know, British figures, people might remember, you know, former prime minister, went on a big role at the UN, you know, generally seen now as very progressive, particularly on issues around drug use and things like that. I mean, she was ardently against it, you know, and you know, Dana will remember that well. I mean, absolutely vehemently opposed, even though she's sort of this progressive figure. So yeah, there's just enormous opposition from within the establishment.
Although she's a convert now, right? I was like, she's on the podcast. I think she was on, not to plug another podcast, but I think she was on The Restless Politics, actually, the other day, saying how much she supported it. And so that's down to success of, you know, people like you, Dana, changing people's minds. So I'm going to ask a couple more questions, and then we're going to go to the floor, because I can see there's some juicy ones already lined up in the Q&A. One question is, and maybe this is a bit of a curveball, but I'm interested in it because we as PR campaigners do spend a lot of time, you know, hashing out the arguments, you know, bringing things back to the kind of failings of First Past the Post, both from a justice angle and from sort of pragmatical angle. What is the best argument against MMP or a version of PR that both of you have encountered? And especially I'm interested in one that, you know, came up during the campaign that you found either more difficult to answer, you thought had some legitimacy to it. And I suppose then obviously the question is, how did you respond to it? Let's come to Dana first and then to Mike.
Well, I think that the List MPs, and even today, people don't think that List MPs do anything. And there was a time when I think Shirtcliffe had these cartoons or TV things of a whole lot of people with paper bags over their heads, and these were the List MPs who aren't contributing. It's only the electorate MPs who do anything. Well, certainly in the smaller party like the Greens, and in ACT in New Zealand, the List MPs work incredibly hard, and they each have their portfolios and areas of expertise, and I don't think still that the general public necessarily understand. I think that's probably that it was different. You know, I despise some of the leaders who were against it. I think that it was very poor of Helen Clark and other people, although I'm a supporter of Helen's in other areas.
How about you, Max? What were the sort of killer argument that you thought was like difficult to counter?
I think the main argument that is still used against MMP, and that I think does come up in international discussions from time to time, is the argument that it gives an outsized role to minor parties, and particular those that may hold the balance of power, and so they can achieve policy victories disproportionate to their size. I think that's still an ongoing debate in New Zealand, because it probably is just about the only thing about MMP that even vaguely bothers me. I mean, by and large, I would actually say that it hasn't been the case. And in fact, so since 1996, with the exception of the current government, 2020 to 2023, every government, unsurprisingly, has been a coalition government, because that's part of the point, in the sense of MMP. Because actually, I mean, like in the UK, right, the Conservatives or Labour will poll 30% at any given time, but, get this outright majority. So New Zealand's had coalition governments. By and large, actually, the minor parties haven't enjoyed disproportionate sway. Normally, they get to chalk up a number of policy victories that's roughly proportionate to their share of the coalition. And in fact, because it's quite difficult being a minor party in a coalition. When things go right, the big party tends to take, all the plaudits, all the credit. And when things go wrong, the minor party gets a lot of the blame. And often minor parties have broken apart under the strain of actually being in power. The one exception is we do have this slightly odd centrist party called New Zealand First, which is a bit of a nationalist, nostalgist, kind of quite erratic sort of party. And they, in a number of elections, they have sat right in the middle of the political spectrum. Neither left nor right bloc has had an outright majority. And so New Zealand First, as a centrist party with sort of 5 to 10 seats, has held the balance of power and has been able to play off sort of the Labour-led and the Conservative-led blocs against each other. And certainly in 2017 to 2020, they did win sort of cabinet positions and policy victories and a share of the budget that was disproportionate to their size, and they did wield that influence pretty poorly, I would have to say. So in the greater context of all the benefits that MMP has brought us, and I think that's a relatively minor drawback, but I would personally acknowledge it as a drawback of the system.
I went to a New Zealand First meeting here yesterday with Winston Peters, Max, and 500 devoted people, and I think they'll be a part of the next parliament. But there are still two or three things wrong with MMP. There's a thing called the coattail, whereas if you get an electorate seat, you then get some MPs in proportion to your vote, which I think most thinking people are opposed. And also, I think we should have a proper debate about whether the threshold should come down from 5% to 4%. And we had another commission, was it last year, Max? And he came up with a whole lot of improvements, but the government didn't do anything about it, and certainly the National Party won't. And I don't think, in terms of the number of women have increased, the number of other ethnicities have increased, but I don't think, for instance, National, I don't think they understand how you've got to get. The other thing is you really need to have STV for your electorate selection, because that's still at the moment first past the post. And it means that the person who gets to be an electorate MP often doesn't have the majority support in the electorate, and whether that will ever change for the better, I don't know.
It's sort of quite comforting that it's not the land of milk and honey in terms of needing always to iterate a system and tweak it to make it more democratic. Sorry, go ahead, Max.
Look, just a couple of things I wanted to add off from what Dana said. The question around the threshold is quite crucial. So New Zealand, and I think this is taken straight from the German system, basically said that political parties had to get over 5% of the vote you know, to be represented in Parliament. So if you're running a political party and you've got 4.5% of the vote, that vote is effectively is wasted or gets reallocated to other political parties. Unless, as Dana said, complicatedly, you win an electorate seat, in which case, if you get 4.5% of the vote, then you get 4.5% of the MPs. So that's a little sort of wrinkle there. But yeah, the main question for me there is the level at which the threshold is set. You know, I mean, I think informally, at least, it's set at 5%. Just sort of the idea is, well, it keeps out some of the lunatics. You know, that's never stated as such, but I think that is the informal sort of, you know, operating assumption. I think that's too high because, I mean, the current parliament, I think we've only really got five parties represented. And I think, you know, the idea of MMP is sort of that, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom, you know, that really should get a greater array, greater diversity of political parties. And I think it would be a good argument for having a threshold set more like 2 or 3%, you know, maybe keep the single issue sort of parties out, but, you know, create a much lower barrier to representation of political parties. And that's something to think about in the UK context, mm-hmm. I'm sure. And also just another thing to add to what Dana said. I mean, the changes in the representativeness of the New Zealand Parliament have been pretty striking. And look, some of them might have happened anyway because New Zealand society has changed more widely. But I looked up a couple of stats when I was preparing for this. And I think it was in the 84 years before we had MMP and after the point between when women became eligible to stand for Parliament and when we adopted MMP, we had a grand total of 44 women MPs in about 80 years. And since we've had MMP, we've had over 100 in a much shorter period of time. Last year, we had a fully gender balanced Parliament for the first time in our history. What other stats? Before MMP, we had 8 MPs who identified as being from the Indigenous culture of New Zealand. We're now 25, so that's tripled. We'd never had an MP of Asian ethnicity before MMP. In the current parliament, I think there are 16, and we have the highest proportion of rainbow LGBT plus representatives in the world, apparently.
Wow.
I just read. So MMP has made New Zealand Parliament enormously more diverse, and a lot of that has come through the party lists because electorate campaigns still tend to select for
white
your
men.
Classic sort of confident white men in a suit, exactly,
yeah.
Dana.
Yeah.
And a lot of the extra diversity has come through the list process, whereby parties, because they've got the chance to draw up a list of 60, 70 people, it does sort of, it forces them to think about these issues because it just makes it very obvious if things are unbalanced, but it's also more positively an opportunity for people to put forward the people who would not win those quite dog-eat-dog electorate selection contests.
And to have an experience of a different kind of leadership, as we've seen also most recently, you know, with, I think, we can all talk about Ardern in lots of ways, but I think, you know, something about her leadership that people have noted is that kind of sense that she's brought to New Zealand politics of it not all being about this dog-eat-dog competition. And certainly in the UK, we use her example, bringing the Greens into government even when she didn't need to, as an example of where you don't even have to go with the electoral maths. You can even go beyond that and say collaboration is something to be actively sought rather than just forced into.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
So we're aware of questions. We've got a bunch lined up. Harry, I know you've got some really good ones for us waiting. Do we want to bring on the first questioners, please?
Yep. So we've got three questions lined up. I'll bring them all in and then I'll leave it to you, Max and Dana, to answer them. So first, we've got Sarah.
Hi there. Thank you to Dana and Max for telling us what's been happening in New Zealand. It's given me some reason to feel a bit more optimistic than for a long time. However, my question is about how well educated the New Zealand population is, and in particular, how much about government and the New Zealand electoral system and democracy, etc., is taught in schools, so that when you come to present your referenda and the choice, there's a hope that people know what you're talking about. Because my fear is that we don't have enough of that in our own in the UK. Certainly, I'm in my 60s and I never learnt anything about those things when I was at school. And I, even though I understand that there's something called citizenship in today's schools, it's very rarely given much priority. So it worries me that we've got such a low understanding of how things work anyway here. So I'd like to hear a bit more about the situation.
Brilliant. Well, I'm in my 30s, Sarah, and I never learned about anything out of school. Citizenship was don't take drugs, kids. That was basically it. We didn't learn anything about the system of government or political parties, which is a scandal. We'll come on to the answers in a second. We're just going to take a couple of other questions just for time purposes. Should we grab a couple more questions on the floor? Hold your thoughts.
Joanna.
Brilliant. Hi, Joanna.
Well, I've always thought of New Zealand as an incredibly civilised place, and I don't think Britain and British politics are. And I also agree with the idea that you really, you know, need mood music and you need a fantastic grassroots push. But, you know, when I think about sort of what the grassroots feels about lots of incredibly important things, I don't see either of our kind of binary parties really caring about this. And I mean, I can see why opposition parties want to support change to the voting system when they're not in power. But once they get in, they usually renege on manifesto promises because they're in power. So there's no incentive. So I suppose I'm asking, you know, if it's a bit like turkeys voting for Christmas, how do you motivate politicians to do this? I mean, to do the right thing, basically, particularly if you have very tribal politics where, you know, collaboration is really difficult, which is, of course, what Compass is finding.
Absolutely, Joanna. That's definitely one tricky question about leverage. And we're going to take one more, I think, from David.
Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant.
Hi. My question was really, if I understood correctly, the referendum was very marginal, like 54%. So my question is, has there been any surveys to assess where the population stands now in terms of their satisfaction with MMP? And secondly, has it changed how citizens view politicians now? So is there now more trust in politicians? And has it changed the nature of dialogue around politics? Is there more nuance now in discussions and conversations about politics?
Two great questions, David. In fact, one of them I was going to ask. So you stole my final question, which is excellent. Always helps me save a bit of time. Okay, we'll come to you, Dana. You can pick any questions
well,
out.
Well, just on the last point, we had another referendum in 2011 where 57 voted in favour of retaining MMP. So that was a sort of reinforcing of the then status quo. In terms of young people, there's a lot of cries for citizenship. I don't think we teach citizenship, but there has been quite a strong youth movement to get the voting age reduced to 16. And that won a case at the High Court, which gave it some credence. But I haven't seen, I think the Greens probably believe in that, but I don't think National and Labor are supportive of that. I think that... Joanna said she didn't see any of it. You had very strong anti-nuclear campaigns and people, Green and Common, and people doing all sorts of exciting things. I seem to remember. I'm sure there are certain questions where you have had in the past Yeah, the internet. The politicians. We just really ignored the politicians. We, you know, they weren't, you know, most of them were not supportive of us. And so we didn't bother about them. And so when we got the vote in favour, they had to sort of fall in line. So, I'm appalled that Labour in Britain don't support it. But, you know, don't worry about them. Just get on and get it.
And I mean, to be clear, the Labour membership supports it. It's just the Labour leadership who claim it's not a priority. So that might be one response. Max, over to you. Which combination of those questions do you want to pick up on?
Yeah, look, I mean, I agree with what Dana says. I mean, I think it was, in terms of getting politicians, you know, stopping them from reneging on their promises. Again, I mean, at the risk of repeating, it was just the fact that having got the thing there, got Palmer, got the remit up within Labour, the Royal Commission, that was the thing that sort of created the stick with which to beat the politicians, and then the sort of plague on both your houses thing. So it was just circumstances and planning that forced them into a position where they were accountable, and it was too costly for them to change tack. Rather than any particular virtue on their part, I think. On the other questions, I mean, New Zealand has a very flexible curriculum, unlike the British one, which has become more and more prescriptive, particularly in recent times, although our one is becoming a bit more prescriptive. So there isn't any sort of enforced, if you like, citizenship or civics education, but schools are free to teach it. So what you get, I think, is a very, very patchy teaching of citizenship, and I would imagine it's much better in wealthier state schools than it is in poorer ones. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. But also what that means, it's not a prerequisite to getting MMP or making MMP work. You know, we've managed to do all those things with, frankly, pretty erratic civics education. On the last question, sort of, has it changed how citizens view politicians? Well, I mean, we still have, you know, fairly negative views towards politicians in New Zealand. I don't think they're held in an enormous degree of respect. It definitely hasn't been a cure-all for those things. I guess what I would say, though, is, I mean, you never know what the sort of counterfactual would have been. And I think had we not changed, there's a decent argument that things would be even worse. I mean, and certainly what we had, you know, there's two governments, Labour and then our equivalent of the Conservatives, implementing very sweeping changes that people hadn't voted for. And obviously that's massively corrosive of trust. Well, that just hasn't really happened again. You know, MMP has forced moderation on our political parties. It has, by and large, forced them to hew more closely, not perfectly, obviously they're politicians, but more closely to the things that they've promised they would do. So we have steered a pretty moderate course in our politics for the last 20 to 30 years. Now, some people in New Zealand argue that that's a bad thing because they think that's why we haven't taken more decisive action on climate change. For instance, under the old system, you might have got a Labour government with absolute power, and they could have just, you know, push some climate stuff through. But I'm not particularly convinced by that. I think that the New Zealand public for the last 30 years after the shocks of the 80s and 90s have been in the mood for not very much change. Thank you very much. So actually, MMB has just quite accurately reflected the mood of the nation. So although it probably hasn't drastically increased, trust in politicians, that sort of dynamic is still quite poor in New Zealand. I think there's a very good argument it would be even worse if we didn't have PR.
Yeah, maybe the least worst option is something that then
we've had quite strong school strikes and school marches for climate change, but the government, the politicians aren't doing anything much about that either. So it's not even an issue in this election.
No, but I should also say we also have quite very high voter turnout. Sort of up around 80% for the last election.
That is high.
I mean, that's not sort of necessarily due to MMP. In fact, there's sort of a secular trend of decline. But again, I think arguably MMP, because everyone knows that their vote counts, I think again, arguably it helps bolster that turnout.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got one final round. We're going to squeeze in some three. They've got some three good ones. So Harry, let's get a quick fire round in to close. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to bring in Peggy first.
Real. Hi, Peggy.
Yes, my question has to a large extent been answered. I was very interested in the response from the last question, considering the changes since proportional representation has been in New Zealand. And I think I was looking really to see the way in which Parliament runs and how the debates go, because I think one of the problems we have in the UK at the moment is the very sort of unpleasant tensions and people not working together and really quite unpleasant behaviour. Has that improved at all, do you think, in New Zealand?
That's great. That's the reason I wanted you to come and still ask that question, Peggy, because I think the cultural aspect is really important here and something that we were... So great question. Thank you. Let's get the other couple of questions in, Harry, and then we'll come back to the panellists at the end.
Yeah, so just going to bring in Nikki.
Right. Well, I used to live in New Zealand, and it was between 97 and 2006. And I was really shocked when, as a result of the general election under proportional representation, they ended up without a government. And to me, coming from the British system, this was appalling that the country was actually left without a government for, I don't know how long it was actually, but it seemed a very long time, 2 or 3 weeks it seemed like. And it was while they were trying to kind of try out different coalitions to get their numbers for a majority. And I was just wondering how it kind of, that sort of thing really works. They've maybe got the hang of it now. And do you have to have a coalition that will give you a majority all the way through, or do you kind of get together on specific points and issues?
Great question, Nikki. Little plug for a Compass publication called Minority Report, which sets out the UK version of that and also draws on other countries' examples of coalition building. But we're going to take one more question. Hold those thoughts, Max and Anna. We're going to take a final question. I think we have one from Sean, possibly.
Yes.
Great. Hi, Sean.
Hello. Hi. In the UK, we've seen the Labour's National Policy Forum criticise first past the post as a driver of distrust and alienation in politics, but also claim that there's no consensus or any new system. So my question was, would a citizens' assembly to consult on the choice of PR voting system and help build consensus for change be a good democratic model for the UK to follow? Possibly also with a confirmatory referendum at a later date, once PR's been enacted and tested in a subsequent general election.
Great question, Sean. Hitting all of the compass bingo points there with citizens' assemblies as well as PR and cross-party working. So I'm going to come back to Max and Dana. We'll take Max first and then finish with Dana. Any of those points, questions you want to pick up in the final round?
Yeah, look, I mean, they're all great questions. Taking them in turn, has behaviour in Parliament changed? I mean, I would say in some fundamental senses, not. I mean, we still have an oppositional Westminster type system. It just means you sort of have coalitions going at each other, hammer and tongs, rather than just, you know, Labour versus the Conservatives. So it hasn't changed the beer pit. It hasn't changed the point scoring and during question time. You know, those things, unfortunately, are pretty fundamental. Just changing your electoral system by itself doesn't change that. What it has done, though, I mean, it has created government that is a bit more consensual, I think, because you have coalitions of two or three partners, you know, one larger, one Labour and the Conservatives, but a couple of minor parties typically. And so there has to be a lot more consultation, you know, just amongst those parties, even before anything goes up to cabinet or, you know, gets through cabinet. And so that forces better decision-making, I think. There is much less a sense of unbridled power, which was one of the books that was written about the New Zealand political system. So I think it has sort of, in the more general sense about how politics done, it has created some improvements. But look, I mean, question time still sounds more or less exactly the same as it always has, i.e. terrible. When we were left without a government, yeah, the first MMP election in 1996, we were left without a government for quite some weeks as New Zealand First, that centrist party I mentioned, sort of played Labour and our Conservatives off against each other. But that generally hasn't been replicated. Mostly the coalition sort of building has been pretty swift and pretty straightforward after elections. And it also isn't really a problem. I mean, if you know that that's going to happen, if you know there'll be a period of, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever while the parties negotiate, I mean, it's just a fact of life when everyone just deals with it. And you realise that, of course, that, you know, the country can get on with doing things quite happily without having politicians, you know, it's sort of in power every second of the day. They're possibly less vital than they think they are. So that hasn't been a problem. And lastly, on the point of Citizens Assembly, yes, I'm a huge advocate of them. We've just had our first Citizens Assembly in New Zealand last year in Auckland. Our municipal council here in Wellington, where I am, is just running its first Citizens Assembly. So they're starting to come onto the agenda here. And yeah, I mean, I think you need something that, I mean, firstly, you don't really want politicians, you know, setting the rules by which they play the game. Ideally, and so you do want some other body that's got some independence to that. In New Zealand, that role was fulfilled by the Royal Commission. But I think, yeah, Citizens Assembly of, you know, say 100 representative people would have immense legitimacy, you know, in terms of drawing up something that would seem to be independent and to reflect, you know, the intelligent will of the people. And I mean, that's absolutely the sort of thing that I'd be recommending.
Brilliant. Thanks, Max. And over to you, Dana. What do you want to pick up from those questions?
Well, I can't see the point of having citizens. You know, you've got to, if you have a citizens assembly, you've got to make sure that it's the right sort of representation. And I don't know what Max's experience is, but I would, you know, I'm sure there's much more white men there than there is in the population. You know,
they make it representative.
Fed in Parliament, even dogs work in come in Parliament. We don't have so many billiard tables, and I think there is now a childcare centre. So I think it's probably the number of women or the proportion of women, and women in our house, that have changed the culture. And so parties like the Greens, if you watch Parliament, the Greens do not answer back and participate. You know, you would get wrapped over the knuckles in the Green Party if you participated in all that nonsense. And I don't know that that's vastly interest affected the other party, but that the culture of the Greens is not to behave in those sorts of manners. So I would think it's other things, yeah. And government still goes on in that period where we waited for Winston. I assume the previous government carried on, didn't they, Max? The previous government carried on with the governing while that hanky-panky went on.
And I think that was interesting. I remember I was living in Germany for a while in 2013 when the government also was going through this process, and people were just, it's really normal, you know, several weeks of negotiations, rounds of negotiations. Here, when that happened in 2010, the absolute panic for 48 hours of just coverage of where is Gordon Brown's every move, and, you know, Nick Clegg had been in and out of the Rose Garden, and it was just absolute scenes here. We could not understand the idea that, you know, for 48 hours, we might not have someone who was officially, you know, it's just a cultural change, isn't it? And I think that's important. Brilliant. Thank you so much. A huge, huge thanks to our guests tonight, Max Rashbrook and Dana Glendinning. And a huge, huge thanks to all of you on the call tonight. There were some fantastic questions there. And that's left me with actually just feeling much more kind of reassured and uplifted. And also energised by the idea that, you know, it takes time. But as Dana said, you've just got to keep going with it, and opportunities present themselves, but only if you just keep that foundational build. So obviously that's what we're doing here at Compass. We continue to do that alliance building work, and we continue to work with other organisations who are pushing to change this voting system to allow much more democracy and equality to flow through our politics. So a huge thanks to all of you on the call tonight. A little shout out for the next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, the 10th of October. It will be coming to you live from Labour Party conference inside the belly of the beast with Steve Richards and others as well will be joining us on the call. Until then, a massive thanks again for our colleagues in New Zealand getting up at insane o'clock to be here and to talk about PR, one of the subjects is closest to our hearts. And thanks to all our members, thanks to Harry for moderating, and please do at us at Compass Office, and please do share this episode with a friend if you think somebody needs to know that it is possible to move from first past the post to PR, and for it to go well, and for things to be better, even if it's not, you know, the promised land that we all thought. Things are better in New Zealand than they would, and I think that list of statistics is just a really good motivator for all of us to just keep working and keep making democracy stronger and better. We will get there. It's an if not when, as we say in the PR movement. It's a when, not if. let's just keep working and keep working with colleagues across the globe who are still continuing to build those campaigns. So massive thanks to you all. Please enjoy your rest of your Tuesday night, and we'll see you next time on It's Bloody Complicated.
If you like what you heard today and want to be part of building a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. Plus, you'll be able to join us live on future calls like this one. You can tweet Compass Office or email francis@compassonline.org.uk. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. After all, it's only fair they know it's bloody complicated too.